Timothy, 1 Timothy, chapter 2. Read verses 9 and verse 10. In like manner also, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array, but which becometh women professing godliness with good works. By way of background to 1 Timothy, after Paul was released from his first imprisonment, he revisited several of the cities which he had ministered, and one of those cities was Ephesus. And from chapter 1 and verse 3, we see that he would leave Timothy behind at Ephesus. He says, I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus. And the reason he left them there was to deal with the problems that had arisen in the Ephesian church. Paul went on to Macedonia. Again, verse 3 says, when I went into Macedonia. And it was from Macedonia that Paul would have written this letter to Timothy. And the purpose of the letter is to encourage Timothy in his ministry at Ephesus. In our text, verses 9 and verse 10, Paul has moved from speaking of men, and now he's speaking of women. And the subject is clothing, and the emphasis is modesty in clothing. And due to the environment and the culture of Ephesus, this was a subject that needed to be addressed. Also in our text, we see that he addresses the fact that he addresses women when it comes to the subject of attire does not mean that modest clothing is irrelevant to men. The subject of modesty, of course, pertains to both. Pertains to men and women, pertains to boys, pertains to girls. And due to the predisposed nature of men and women, women are dressed. Women, as a general rule, are predisposed to immodest dress, and men, as a general rule, are sexually stimulated by sight. And Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 28, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. With that being said, the subject of dress must never, ever be used as an excuse for a male in sin sexually. Neither men or women should dress in such a way that turns them into an object of lust. And when you dress in an immodest way, that's what happens. You become an object. You've ceased to become a person. You are now an object. And clothes, of course, have the power to flaunt sensuality, has the power to flaunt sexuality. Margaret Kent wrote a book in 1987 entitled How to Marry the Man of Your Choice. She, of course, was a secular author, and the purpose of the book, of course, is to address women. And she said this, don't let the power of clothing pass you by, for it can be a major asset in attracting men. To stir his sexual imaginations, wear clothing that follows the natural form of the body. Now that's what Paul is instructing against. here in 1 Timothy 2 in verse 9. But neither men or women are to dress in a way that would appeal to the baser instincts of nature. And in the last part of verse 9, he goes on to say, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array. So there he in verse 9, he is warning against sensuality. He is warning against excess. He is warning against extravagance when it comes to clothing. What Paul is saying here in these verses is God does have a dress code. He is saying, do not be guilty of being improperly clothed. He's saying clothing and how we wear it does matter. So we want to speak tonight on the subject of the attitude of modesty in dress. We're going to make this two parts. I was going to make it one. It was way, way too long. So we'll make it two, and next week we'll get into what is modest dress. But tonight we want to consider the attitude of modesty in dress. First of all, the importance of dress. The mere reading of 1 Timothy 2:9, the mere reading of it out loud causes annoyance in some people, causes them to be irritated. Just the mere reading of it. Don't have to say anything. Just the mere reading causes anger in folks. The fact that the mere reading of these verses stirs such strong emotion attests to the importance of the subject matter. Now, the environment that Timothy was living in, that the church of Ephesus was in, made this subject a matter of great importance. And Ephesus, of course, was the center of pagan worship, truly evil city. It was steeped in vanity, and that's why he spoke about broided hair and gold and pearls and costly array. It was steeped in idolatry. And, of course, it was engrossed in immorality and perversion and obscenity and lewdness. And much of this would carry over into the attitudes and the lives of God's people in the church of Ephesus. So our text needs to be read in the light of the environment. In Ephesus was the temple of Diana. In that inner shrine was the image of the goddess of Diana, who was thought to be the symbol of fertility. She was the fertility goddess. Businessmen would flock into the temple of Diana to have their sexual fantasies fulfilled by religious prostitutes, and it was a religious type service. And so we see Ephesus was an immoral city. Ephesus was an amoral society, and amorality is really worse than immorality, but that's a different subject. And in that society, of course, was nakedness and sexual expression. And in our text, Paul is speaking to the saved of Ephesus, and what he's basically saying is do not imitate the appearance of the immoral that are around you. Do not regard those court women in the Temple of Diana, which were religious prostitutes. Do not let them be your fashion role models, is what he's telling them. Today, it's the equivalent of warning God's people to stay away from the imitation of styles set by the promiscuous. He is warning them, do not allow the ungodliness, the sensuality, and the immorality of society determine the way that you dress. And God's people should never allow society to determine what we wear. He is saying, do not allow the fashion industry, do not allow the entertainers to define what is beautiful and appropriate apparel. God's already defined that. It's to be modest apparel. And as we'll see next week, God makes that quite clear what that is as well. So like Ephesus, American culture is obsessed with sensuality, sexuality. We are a sex-obsessed, sex-crazed, sex-saturated society where sensuality and immorality are encouraged in a variety of ways. And that's true from a very young age. It's pretty sick that a father would encourage his 2- and 3-year-old daughter to dress in an immodest way. In American culture, blatant sexuality is in the forefront. And, of course, there is an incessant bombardment of inappropriate sexuality. And people are constantly assaulted with sexual motives and thoughts and inundated with the message and enticements of distorted sexuality. So living in the midst of such a society, the clothes that we wear, and again we'll even go further, and how we wear them does matter. It does matter. And it is of extreme importance. We also see the importance of clothes as seen from the fact that clothes send a message. And one of the reasons that Paul addresses the subject of clothes was the fact that clothes do send a message. Many people, of course, will say it does not matter what I wear. God looks upon the heart. Well, that is true that God does look upon the heart, but it is not true that it does not matter what you wear and how you wear it. It does matter. And people cannot help but see our clothing. You can't get around that. People see our clothing. They notice whether we are sloppy or neat, simple or glamorous, provocative or modest. People notice those things just in clothing. And they have a perception of us based upon what we wear and how we wear it. In other words, our clothing makes a statement. It can reflect on what we think of ourselves. It can tell of our morality. When Adam and Eve sinned against God, first thing they did was they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons, which prompted God to ask, "Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I have commanded thee that thou shouldst not eat?" You see, those fig leaf aprons sent a message that they were sinners and that they were rebels against God. Clothes not only send a message, they identify. All through the Bible, we see clothes for different occasions that identify people with different things. In Genesis 35, verses 1 through 3, Jacob is told to go to Bethel to worship. And he says to his servants, "Be clean and change your garments." Why? Because we're going to worship. Change your garments. And people today have the attitude, it doesn't matter how I dress coming in the house of God, but it does matter. And we see here that they were to change their garments just because they were going to worship the Lord. In Genesis 38, verse 14, Tamar put off her widow's garments. So you see, there were special garments for a widow. It identified this woman is a widow. It sent that message. It communicated that message. In Exodus 28 and 29, we read of the priest's garments. So there were garments specifically for the priest that identified them as priest. In 2 Samuel 13 and 18, we read of a garment of diverse colors, and then that is identified as the robes of the king's daughters. So you see, the king's daughters wore different clothing than anyone else. And when someone saw a young lady in those clothes, they knew this is the daughter of a king. Clothes identify. Clothes send a message. In 2 Samuel 14 and verse 2, we read of mourning, not mourning AM, but mourning, grieving apparel. So when someone was grieving, they wore a certain apparel, and it identified them that they were in mourning. In Proverbs 7 and verse 10, we read of the attire of an harlot. So there was clothes that identified a woman as a harlot. Those clothes sent a message, I am a harlot, I am available. Just the clothes she wore sent that message. In Matthew chapter 22, we read of a wedding garment, certain clothes that you wore to a wedding. So the point is, clothes send a message. The point is, clothes declare identity. And we could give many, many examples of such. Mary Quant, she was the designer of the miniskirt in 1960. And she said this, I designed it to announce to the world that I was ready to go to bed with man day or night. That's why she designed it. That dress sent that message in her mind. That was the message of that dress. So our clothing and the way we wear it says something. It may say what you do not intend it to say, but our clothing says something. And our clothing, as children of God, should say, I love the Lord, and I'm committed to Him. Our clothes should never say, I reject the Lord's authority. Our clothes should never, ever say that as a child of God. God, of course, puts emphasis upon clothing. Again, many will say, God does not care what I wear. But God commanded Moses with regard to the children of Israel meeting God at Sinai in Exodus 19 and 10. He said, let them wash their clothes. If they're going to come before me, they need to wash their clothes. Sounds to me that clothes mattered. Wash their clothes. They were not to come into his presence with dirty clothes. He wanted them to be clean in dress. In Exodus 28, God gives very detailed and explicit instructions for the making of the garments of the priest. How interested was God in the clothing of the priest? He directed concerning the colors. He directed concerning the fabrics. He directed according for the design and the pattern of the embroidery. The reason, clothing does matter to God. It does matter. And again, we could give many verses, many examples throughout the Old Testament. Zephaniah 1 and verse 8 talks about strange clothing of God's people. That is, it was something that did not line up with God's standard, and it was referred to as strange clothing. So, that just a brief on the importance of clothing. And when someone says, well, it doesn't matter what I wear, you're sadly mistaken. It does matter. It does matter. The foundation of proper dress. This is so important. 1 Timothy 2 begins with men. And the subject is prayer. In verse 8 of 1 Timothy 2, Paul stated the duty of men, that men pray everywhere. Now, again, just like when we come to clothing, it doesn't just apply to women, and prayer certainly does not just apply to men. But he's addressing men, and the subject is prayer. And he went on to state the manner or way in which they were to pray. He says, lifting up hands. No, it's lifting up holy hands. The word holy, of course, states a condition. The condition in which one is to pray. Holy. To spread the hands toward heaven throughout the Scriptures is indicative of prayer. And the matter in which it is to be done is indicated by those two words, holy hands. Holy hands. That is, that which is set apart for God and undefiled and pure. That's how men were to pray. They were to be in a state where they were set apart for God, where their lives were clean and pure, and now they're in a place where they can pray. It goes on to say there in verse 8 that the duty of prayer was to also be done without wrath. That is, without any evil passion or anger towards another individual. And then it says, and doubting. Without wrath and doubting. In other words, it was to be done with reflection and thought. He's telling them how they were to pray. So from this verse, verse 8, we see that prayer, of course, is the external act. It's the outward act, lifting up of holy hands. It's the outward act, lifting up of hands. But it is to proceed from an internal condition and spirit, holy, without wrath, and doubting. You move from verse 8 to verse 9. In like means the same. So in the same manner speaks of the way in which something is done. Also, that is, in addition to what I've said about men, that women. So what he's saying is that women are also to be holy and to possess a right spirit. And then what does he focus upon? Her attire, her dress. In like manner also that women. So that's the prelude to the subject of attire. In like manner also. So the subject of attire or dress is brought up in the context of holiness and the right spirit. So coming to verse 9, we have a different subject is now being addressed, but the foundation is the same. The same as it was in prayer. The foundation is holiness and a right spirit. So the subject is no longer prayer, but the subject now is modesty in apparel. And the foundation is internal. The foundation is internal. So the subject of modesty and attire does not simply regard the external. Just as prayer does not simply regard the lifting up of hands, there has to be holy hands. So there's an inward principle that manifests itself externally. So modesty is not first, I said first, is not first an issue of clothing. I did not say modesty has nothing to do with clothing. That's not what I said. Modesty is not first an issue of clothing. It is first and primarily an issue of the heart. One should be modest in heart. And that, of course, translates into modesty externally, including dress. So proper attire and dress does not make one holy. Now, that statement should not surprise anyone. Everyone should know that. But you preach in most Baptist churches, and I'm sorry, that statement shocks folks. Because they've been convinced, as long as I dress modestly, I'm right with God. What you put on does not make you right with God. What you put on does not make you holy. If you're right with God and you're holy, you're going to want to dress in a way that manifests that. So external dress or attire does not make us right with God. Holiness makes us right with God. And that's the foundation of this modest apparel. So holiness and a right spirit is the governing principle of modest apparel. Now there are two erroneous extremes regarding external and internal. One is externals do not matter because God looks upon the heart. Yes, God does look upon the heart, but externals do matter. The other extreme is putting the emphasis upon the external to the neglect of the internal. And that is where God's people more likely are going to fall rather than the other. Both are disastrous. Both are absolutely disastrous. To say externals do not matter, that's disaster. To say that the heart does not matter, that produces nothing but Pharisees, self-righteous, proud individuals. That's all that produces. So they're both disastrous. And what we have to realize is the Word of God never, never pits internal against external. In other words, it's not either or. It's both. It's both. You have to be right with God in your heart, and that results in being right with God externally or manifesting that. So who and what we are as the redeemed of the Lord should manifest itself externally in everything about us, even the way we dress. So holiness is the governing power of the external. Holiness is first. Again, holiness is twofold. The root is separated unto God. That's first. And the other, of course, is purity. Surrender unto God. This must be so. And we see the order in Romans 12, 1 and 2. Present your bodies unto God. Unto God. Unto God. That's the foundation. And then we read in verse 2, and be not conformed to this world. Be not conformed is not the emphasis. The emphasis is present your body unto God. That will result in be not conformed to this world. So the internal is the governing power of the external. So holiness is more than knowledge. You can know the Bible backwards and forwards. That doesn't mean you're holy. Holiness is more than a profession of faith. People can profess faith. People can profess godliness. People can profess holiness. That doesn't make it so. So holiness is more than knowledge. It's more than profession. It's more than respectability. It's more than morality. I praise God for a lost person that's moral. But that doesn't mean they're holy. It's more than outward appearance, holiness. That doesn't do away with the importance of outward appearance, but we have to understand that holiness is the foundation. So what is holiness? Well, holiness involves the impression and workmanship of God in a person. And if that is so, if that is going on in our lives, then we will do that which is right externally, whether it be dress or whatever. We see holiness as a state of heart of devotion to God, which controls the believer's life. Holiness is a consecration to God. It's a heart set apart for God and His glory and His service. So we see in our text, holiness is the prelude to modest dress. That's the prelude to it. Holiness is to be preached. Modest dress. But holiness is the prelude to modest dress. So again, can't say it enough, modest dress does not make you holy. It does not make you right with God. But holiness will cause you to want to dress in a modest way. So the foundation is holiness. Also in verse 10, but which becometh women professing godliness. So her clothing is to be becoming of one who professes godliness. Book of Titus. The grace of God teaches us to live godly in this present world. Now, godliness and godly are two different things. They're connected, of course. Godliness is inward. It's inward. Godly, live godly in this present world, that's outward. But once again, it's the inward that is the foundation of the external. It is the power to the external. So holiness and godliness will reveal itself externally, even in the way that one dresses. If someone is holy, if someone is godly, they will not have an issue in this matter of dress. It's not even an issue. Not even an issue. And I'm not going to argue with somebody. They don't want to dress right. I'm not going to try to necessarily convince them because the need is they need to be holy. They need to be godly. That takes care of the problem. The problem is a spiritual matter, an internal spiritual matter. So notice as we go on here in verse 9 that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, and we're going to get to that next week, with, that is, accompanied by or alongside. So this modest apparel is to be accompanied by or alongside the modest apparel is to be shamefacedness. Again, that speaks of something inward. What is shamefacedness? It's not a word that we use much today. But it is the shame that will prevent one from doing a wrong act. Again, this is in the context of modest apparel. It is the shame. So there is a shame involved in immodest apparel. We'll get to that more next week also. So shamefacedness is that which shrinks back from pressing the limits on modesty. Shamefacedness says this, I am going to be reserved and show honor because I do not want to contribute to, and I do not want to stir or provoke anything that is shameful. So therefore, I will dress modestly. Again, more on that next week. Shamefacedness is a state of mind that causes you to be concerned with modesty. Someone says, well, I just put it on. I didn't even think about it. You need some shamefacedness. Shamefacedness causes you to be concerned what you've just put on, how it's going to affect someone else. Is this going to be a stumbling block to someone else? Shamefacedness means that you're quick to blush. So in other words, if immodest clothing does not make you blush, what you have an internal problem. You do not have shamefacedness. Shamefacedness would cause you to blush at the thought of putting on something immodest and going out in public. And many, of course, obviously do not have shamefacedness. So, in this case, it is to blush at the thought of calling attention to the body, because that's what immodest dress does. It calls attention to the body. Shamefacedness does not want to call attention to the body. Shamefacedness is not wanting to dress in a way that may affect someone else in a shameful way. Again, what Jesus said, if any man look on a woman to lust after her, he hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. A woman that has shamefacedness does not want to dress in a way that might provoke someone to look in her direction. And if someone does look in her direction, that does not excuse them, as we said at the beginning. So almost any time you bring up the subject of modesty in dress, someone will always ask, well, where exactly is the line between modest and immodest? That very question displays a lack of shamefacedness. Shamefacedness addresses the lying question. You see, shamefacedness has no desire to get near the line. But the individual who asks, well, where exactly is the line? They want to get just as close as they can. But shamefacedness doesn't want to get anywhere near the line. Then notice also, and sobriety. Modest apparel with shamefacedness, that is, alongside of modest apparel is shamefacedness and sobriety. Meaning, good judgment. Good judgment. A woman who dresses, or a man who dresses in a provocative way, has not exercised good judgment. It means self-control as well. It signifies a restraint. It is the condition of heart that would cause us to draw away from trespassing the boundaries of propriety or what's decent. Sobriety speaks of exercising restraints over our thoughts, over our preferences, over our desires. You see, it's not a matter, well, this is cute. It's not a matter of cuteness. It's a matter of modesty. That's the only thing that matters. Well, I like the color. The color is not the issue. Modesty is the issue. And someone who possesses sobriety will ask themselves, why am I wearing this? And that's a good question to ask. Why am I wearing this? What is my purpose of putting this on? When someone puts on a skirt that comes up to here, what is their purpose of doing so? Well, to keep cool. I'm sorry. I don't believe that. And besides, that's not true anyway. It doesn't keep you cool. Is what I'm wearing inviting the lust of the opposite sex? Sobriety asks those questions. Is what I'm wearing hinder my profession of godliness? Is it contrary to my profession of godliness? What message am I sending? When you go outside half naked, what message are you sending? It's a good question to ask. So the words with shamefacedness and sobriety speak of the spirit in which one is to wear their clothes. The words with shamefacedness and sobriety speak of a condition of heart, and they are elements of Christian character, and they are linked to attire, to apparel. They are linked elements of Christian character are linked to the way we dress. And the reason some people don't care how they dress is because they lack these essential elements of Christian character. Shamefacedness and sobriety, godliness. So again, those who possess these elements of Christian character, they don't push the limits to moral acceptability when it comes to clothing. You know, in the 1920s, people were writing in newspapers, editorials, dresses were coming a little bit above the ankles. And I believe someone, I don't have it with me, someone said, it could get so bad that eventually it'll be just below the knee. And that's how they thought. Now, just that much below the knee would be an improvement for many. So those who possess these elements do not push the limits. Again, in verse 10, dressing in a modest way with shamefacedness and sobriety. And that's elaborated upon in verse 10 by saying that it becometh women professing godliness. A heart right with God will cause one to want to dress in the interest of godliness. They will want to dress in the interest of godliness. They will want to dress in a way that says, I love the Lord, and I am under His authority. So what Paul's, in closing, what Paul states in our text reveals that the subject of modest clothing is not trivial. It does matter. It does matter. And we could preach a message on this, but again, when the people were going to come before God and worship, clothing mattered. Clothes mattered. Still does. God requires modest dress. It's a heart that's not right with God that strives to push the limits. Modesty for a child of God should not be a controversial issue. It really shouldn't. It should never be a matter of controversy, and it should never be a questionable matter. Everyone knows what's modest. And if you don't, come back next week and we'll tell you. But when it comes to clothing, like anything else, the glory of God should be our primary aim. That should be our primary aim in everything that we do. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20 says, glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are God's. So all these people say, I can dress any way I want to, it's my body. First of all, that's a wrong premise. It's not your body, it's God's. And God wants you to dress in a modest way. God wants you to dress in a way that covers and conceals. So it does matter. It's not your body. We're to glorify God in our body. 1 Corinthians 10:31, do all to the glory of God. Is clothing exempt from that? Of course not. In Colossians 3, verse 17, for whatsoever you do in word or do all in the glory of God. So everything we do is to be done for the glory of the Lord. Everything. That includes the places we go. That includes the way we talk. It includes everything. There are no individual compartments here. It includes everything. And it certainly includes the way both men and women dress. And any time we try to push the limits, we try to just get on the edge, that manifests a spiritual problem. It manifests a lack of shamefacedness, because shamefacedness doesn't want to be on the edge of immodesty. So again, women are to adorn themselves, applies to men as well, in modest apparel. Next week we'll look at those words, adorn, apparel, and modest. And those three words pretty much define what constitutes modesty in dress, what is pleasing to God. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us.